from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a look back at the biggest news stories of 2015 and what's to come in the new year. It's been a year of refugees, politics, hope, anger, fear. More than a million migrants and refugees hit Europe this year. In September, many were stranded at the Serbian-Hungarian border, the BBC reported.
Chanting open the door again and again, but it will have no effect on the Hungarian side. There is real determination over there not to let people through.
But through they came. There were terrible shootings by white Christians, by a Muslim couple, and hot politics. In San Bernardino, 14 died. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump called to block Muslim entry to the United States.
Yeah, several down in the conference room, several down.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
And there were sharp tensions again over race and policing. Protesters took to the streets of Baltimore demanding answers in the death of Freddie Gray.
I want to know what happened. Why did it happen? Because I know if that were my family member, I need closure.
This hour On Point, heading into Christmas and New Year's, we're wrapping up the year with Karen Tumulty of The Washington Post, David Sanger of The New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's your top story of this year? What's going to matter to last, most shape the year ahead? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. With us today, Christmas Eve, from Washington, is Karen Tumulty, national political correspondent for The Washington Post. Karen, welcome back. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, hi, Tom. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. And from Washington, David Sanger is with us, national security correspondent for The New York Times. David, welcome. You're not in Vermont this year. What's up?
Well, you know, I'll make it there sooner or later. Okay. I couldn't turn down 70-degree weather in Washington.
Right. Cherry
Happy
blossoms.
Holidays, Tom and Karen.
Yes, thank you very much, David, and thank you so much for being here. And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack. Best of the season, sir.
And to you, Tom, and David, and Karen.
All right. We've got a lot to look at here. People scattering next week, but we wanted to look back on this amazing year. Not all glorious amazing, but so much has unfolded this year. And Karen Tumulty, I'm looking at your list here. We said, what are your top stories? And we almost don't want to see it, but there it is, the Donald, right at the top of your list, or the Donald phenomenon. You have been covering politics for a long time, plenty of presidential politics. What do you make of the rise of this man with his message in this year, Karen?
Well, and that was probably at the top of my list because I spend my days covering politics. I think that his candidacy has really sort of awakened a lot of us to, you know, an anger that is out there in this country, I think that we, and certainly the establishment ranks of the Republican Party, did not fully appreciate. And so time after time after time, he has done things that would have sunk any other candidate, and it only seems to make him stronger. And I was recently talking to a voter in Nevada who told me, he said, you know, I'm probably going to vote for Bernie Sanders, and I really hate the way that Donald Trump says things, but I'm kind of glad he's saying them. And so I think that is, you know, it may be a minority sentiment, but it is certainly, you know, keeping him at the head of the field.
Karen, your headline, it's almost a month ago now, was, will Trump eventually cross a line or do the lines no longer exist? What do you say?
I think that for Donald Trump, the lines no longer exist. The question is whether, to me, is whether he has just changed the whole nature of our politics, or whether this is a sort of phenomenon that is very specific to this candidate and this time.
David, Jack, I want to come to you on this, but let's just listen just from this week. I mean, you can sort of pick just anywhere. But we had the Democratic debate on Saturday night. Hillary Clinton took a little longer getting back from, I guess, a bathroom break. So what? Big deal. Here was Trump in Michigan on Monday talking about her absence from the stage.
I know where she went. It's disgusting. I don't want to talk about it. No, it's too disgusting. Don't say it. It's disgusting.
Disgusting? It's human, but not just that. There were journalists at the back of the hall, and this Republican presidential candidate pointed them out over the big crowd there, good-sized crowd. Here he is talking about reporters covering America's presidential campaign.
By the way, I hate some of these people, but I'd never kill them. I hate them. These people, honestly, I'll be honest. I would never kill them. I would never do that.
Hate them? Kill them? Never kill them? David Sanger, what is going on here?
Well, the most remarkable thing here is that he is a creature of them. I mean, the amazing rise of Donald Trump has been aided by a fully connected society run largely in the news end by the patter of cable TV that loves Trump. I mean, the more outrageous he is, the more ratings go up. People are sort of watching the approaching car crash here. What outrageous thing can he say next? I think the big question, and this is more Karen's territory than my own, is after they have vented this anger, which is very real, after they have rejected the establishment, which is real, after they have vented about mainstream media, can they actually bring themselves to vote for somebody like Donald Trump, knowing what difference that will make to the world? And I have my doubts still.
Difference it will make to the world. That gets us into your territory. Let's say he would be elected. What difference would it make to the world?
Well, you'd have a president who has suddenly declared that he's going to build walls across the Mexican border and get the Mexicans to pay for it. I believe the wall building part, I'm having a hard time figuring out how he's going to do that, who is going to ban people from the United States on religious basis, which I think would probably feed more than any single thing the narrative of events that ISIS is having. And this is what Hillary Clinton is sort of playing on. She's using each individual Trumpism to make the point that either he is, as she said last week, aiding ISIS, or as her aide said this week after the clip that you ran, using this to try to solidify her base among women voters, many of whom, particularly younger women voters, have not been particularly enthralled with Hillary Clinton's campaign because they're convinced that sooner or later in their lifetimes there'll be a woman candidate and they're not necessarily sure she has to be the one.
Recruiter-in-chief.
I'm sorry, that there would be a woman president.
President. Recruiter-in-chief for ISIS, Hillary Clinton says of Donald Trump. Well, or maybe recruiter for Hillary Clinton herself. We'll see, and we'll see soon enough. Republicans worried about this. In New Hampshire, Jack Beattie, your backyard there, headlines today saying they're trying to guilt trip Republican voters there into not voting for Trump. And here was Jeb Bush, this was last week in New Hampshire, using a line we also heard in the debate, but speaking up against the Trump campaign.
Just one other thing, I got to get this off my chest. Donald Trump is a jerk.
Thank you.
You cannot insult your way to the presidency.
Jack Petey, this is wild. Wherever you stand on Trump, I've never heard this kind of dialogue in presidential campaigning before. Donald, you know, a fellow candidate is a jerk. You can't insult your way to the presidency. Where are we? Where's the GOP here, Jack?
Well, you know, Tom, I think those most responsible for the Trump distemper are those most threatened by it now. 60% of Republicans feel betrayed by Republican politicians. Give us Congress, they said, and we'll repeal Obamacare, financial reform, stimulus spending, climate change regulations. The Pauls kept none of these promises. As Oklahoma's Tom Cole quipped, you're not going to repeal Obamacare with a guy named Obama in the White House. But that concession to reality was not passed on to the GOP base. All they heard was grotesque hyperbole. For example, that Obamacare was a government takeover of health care. PolitiFact deemed that the lie of the year in 2010, just as Trump's collective bombast is the top lie this year. GOP incumbents are terrified of sharing the ballot with the voice of the angry base. You know, a line from a Yeats poem on the Irish Civil War speaks to their dilemma. They had fed the heart on fantasy. The heart's grown brutal from the fair.
Karen,
Are you buying that? I mean, after all, Donald Trump, he doesn't exactly channel that. He once spoke of single-payer health care, universal health care.
I don't really think this is an ideological thing at all with him. I think he is speaking to more of a frustration, and it is a frustration with politicians saying things and not following through on them, with a sense that, you know, we're in a scary world and it's getting scarier. You know, I would have thought the attacks in Paris followed by the attacks in San Bernardino would have, you know, brought the dialogue to a more sort of sober, serious, place, at least with regard to foreign policy. But instead, what we have seen is Donald Trump, after proposing to ban Muslims from entering this country, is now in the high 30s among Republican primary voters. And 5 or 6 weeks ago, the only the only consolation that Republican leaders had was this assumption that he had a ceiling of under 30% of their electorate. Now he's smashed right through that.
Karen Tumulty with The Washington Post, national political correspondent there. Please stand by on this Christmas Eve. And David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. We'll come back and look at exactly Paris, San Bernardino, the Islamic State, and more with you, David. Jack Beatty, it's great to have you here. We're looking at a year in the news, the big stories, top stories of 2015, and how they look as we head toward this year's end. Behind us there, Ornette Coleman, one of those who died this year, lonely woman. Listeners, you can join us. What's your top story from 2015? What's going to matter long term? Which stories this year will move from news to history? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a year in the news today as we head into Christmas tomorrow. It's Christmas Eve and New Year's right behind. We're looking at the big stories, top stories of 2015 and how they look as we head toward the year's end. David Sanger is with us, national security correspondent for The New York Times, author of Confront and Conceal. Karen Tumulty is with us, national political correspondent for The Washington Post and all over the presidential campaigns. On Point news analyst Jack Beatty is here, and you can join us as well as we close out the year. How are you looking at the Islamic State, Black Lives Matter, the refugees, mass shootings in the USA, the rise of Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, all what comes ahead in 2016? What's going to matter, most matter, from this year, 2015. Of course, Black Lives Matter was all over this year. Just yesterday, Mall of America, we heard protesters there trying to draw awareness to last month's police shooting of 24-year-old Jamar Clark in Minneapolis. You hear the call echoing there in the shopping mall. You can hear it on the Golden Mile in Chicago today, on Michigan Avenue as well. Bernie Sanders out there this year bringing out big crowds all about the economy. Here he was at the first Democratic debate in Las Vegas.
The middle class of this country for the last 40 years has been disappearing. Millions of Americans are working longer hours for lower wages. And yet almost all of the new income and wealth being created is going to the top 1%.
The Bernie Sanders economic message, and he delivers it again and again. But again and again, it's been up against security issues, especially this fall. November 13th, terrorist attacks in Paris, 130 dead there, many more injured. On the day after the attack, French President François Hollande addressed his country, France.
Face à la guerre, le pays doit prendre les décisions appropriées.
Faced with war, the country has to take appropriate steps. It's an act of war committed by a terrorist army, Daesh, an Islamist army, against France, against the values we uphold throughout the world, against who we are, a free country which speaks to the whole planet.
The French dealing with a slaughter right there in the French capital, Paris. David Sanger, step back with your perspective on the Islamic State, ISIS this year, both on its own turf
and reaching out there very heavily into the world, into the heart of Europe.
Well, we've had a lot of surprises this year, Tom, in the constant battle between the forces of chaos and the forces of order. And ISIL is the number one force of chaos. I think a year or two ago, it's fair to say that few expected them to not only hold the kind of territory they're able to hold in Iraq and Syria, but to reach out in Europe, reach out in, at least ideologically in the United States. And Paris was a operation that was commanded by ISIL. San Bernardino and the killings there were one that was clearly inspired, though not ordered, by ISIL. And what that's done is spread chaos elsewhere. So ISIL came up because Syria was itself a collapsing state. And what we know about terror groups is they thrive in places where there is no governance, thus Syria, thus parts of Iraq, and now Libya as well. And that created a migrant crisis, which is threatening much of Europe. So France gets hit at the moment that the European Union is probably facing the greatest crisis of its time. So what was the force of order out of all of this? It was another unlikely event. It was the agreement with Iran. So if you had asked
the
people—
The
nuclear deal with Iran. So if you had asked people 3 years ago, what's more likely, that ISIS will rise or that Iran will reject any kind of nuclear deal and will get into a military conflict with Tehran, I think most people would have voted for the second, and it came out the other way. And I think in many ways, the Iran nuclear agreement, which is a long ball pass by the Obama administration, a bet that over time Iran will actually become a stabilizing, more moderate influence in the Middle East, may turn out, when we look back at this, to be the more lasting news story. But ISIS, for now, even though it is a force that I don't think can seriously threaten the United States in an existential way, but can certainly cause a lot of death and chaos around the world, that appears to be the more imminent threat.
Hold that security thought. I want to put it into a political context for a moment. Karen Tumulty, I mean, before the Paris attacks in the theater there, 130 dead, so shocking in November, lots of other things were on people's minds. Bernie Sanders, of course, economy most of all. Since the Paris attacks and then San Bernardino, it's all about security. How do you see these things playing out against each other? It's security versus what for the mind of the American voter in 2016, Karen?
Well, the Democrats, it was really interesting to hear the Democrats debate last Saturday, just 4 days after the Republicans had debated in Las Vegas. Mm-hmm. And all of the Democrats were intent on tying national security to economic security. They said, you know, and Bernie Sanders said, you know, people are feeling anxious about a lot of things. And they're also feeling anxious about the fact that they're working longer hours and not feeling like they're getting ahead.
Yep.
So I think that, and compared to the Republican debate, which was just, you know, who could sound tougher on ISIS. So I think the Democrats are betting that this comes back to a lot of the things that were driving politics before these attacks. And, you know, the Republicans, this has become a foreign policy election to them.
Is at this point, is the Islamic State able to kind of bounce American politics on a string? I mean, pull off more attacks and they can veer all of our political conversation into security land instead of everything else that might be on the agenda?
Well, I think certainly San Bernardino is proof of that.
Of course, you know, not centrally orchestrated by all accounts, just people responding and going for it.
Freelancing, but inspired, you know, by ISIS.
And boom, we're there in a hurry. I want to get a call right here. Brandon in Nashville, Tennessee. Brandon, thank you for calling on Christmas Eve. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Well, what do you see, Brandon?
Man, I really feel like the frustration that most people have is not necessarily due to ISIS. It's due to what you guys were just talking about. It's due to what we do after a supposed ISIS attack. And I feel like that's the most frustrating, is because each candidate I've heard of so far have said, the most important thing for a president is the number one thing of keeping America safe. And I have absolutely no idea where in the Constitution it says that the number one goal is to keep America safe. The number one goal actually in constitutions and Bill of Rights is to keep America free and to keep America sovereign. So I think what frustrates most us, especially combat veterans, is to know that whenever you get back, those specific things that you were fighting for are basically under challenge just due to because we've developed this new rule, I guess, that the number one reason to be for a president is to keep the American safe, and that's so annoying.
Brendan, we've got it. And, I mean, there is the commander-in-chief role, and it's right there. But you want to come home, if you're in the armed forces, to a country that is holding to the ideals that you're fighting for. Jack Beatty, what did you see in this year on the front of this commander-in-chief, this president, taking on, I guess this is at the head of the line of foreign policy issues?
Well, you know, Tom, the president saw success in high diplomacy this year. The nuclear deal with Iran, as David said, the Pacific Trade Pact, diplomatic recognition of Cuba, climate change agreement in Paris, but perceived failure on the ground in the Middle East. Only 37% approve of his handling of ISIS, and events have been contradicting his comments about terrorism with rude celerity. One day, he said ISIS was contained. The next day, ISIS attacked Paris. On a recent morning, he told CBS, "Our homeland security has never been more protected." Hours later came San Bernardino. The president is right. The GOP candidates have proposed really not very convincing alternatives to his strategy on ISIS, but he would have done better to have told us the truth that any containment of ISIS will be porous and that the homeland can't be secured against self-radicalized terrorists.
I mean, here he was talking at his year-end press conference in Washington last Friday saying, look, he's not done. He's optimistic. He's going to leave it all on the field.
I plan on doing everything I can with every minute of every day that I have left as president to deliver on behalf of the American people. Since taking this office, I've never been more optimistic about a year ahead than I am right now. And in 2016, I'm going to leave it out all on the field.
David Sanger, you're talking about this president calling for patience and national unity. The question that has arisen in the country is there a working strategy here that is indeed working for security on this front?
Well, you know, what's interesting when you listen to that press conference, and I thought it was a fascinating one, is it tells you how much President Obama is focused on the long game. And while that's something that theoretically I think most Americans want, they want their president thinking out in 5, 10, 15-year terms. When you are faced with an immediate crisis, which he did not communicate very well by his own admission after Paris and after San Bernardino, didn't sound particularly reassuring, it can undercut those long-term agreements. So Jack ran through what would be for any president a significant number of victories this year, and most of it got washed away in the news cycle. So then your question is there a real strategy about ISIL? And I think the answer to that is there is an evolving one, but it came about pretty late. When the president decided
to put this against the, you know, context for President Obama, which is that, you know, his rationale, one of the main reasons he was elected president in 2008 was to pull us out of Iraq and ultimately Afghanistan, mm-hmm. to move us out of these wars. And, you know, everything about the Islamic State threat seems to be pulling us back in. And it's, you know, very much a part of his legacy to have ended the wars over there and to, you know, have spoken to a country that really is pretty weary of constant combat.
Karen, Karen makes a really mm-hmm. fascinating point, because when you listen to the Republican candidates, particularly after San Bernardino, they sounded more like George W. Bush in his first term. Mm-hmm. I mean, all of the discussion was about bombing. You had Ted Cruz talking about carpet bombing, something nobody in the United States has done since the Vietnam War and is now widely considered to be a war crime. You had all of this tough talk and very little discussion about how you get to the roots of radical Islamic terrorism. And that's almost as if we hadn't learned the lessons of the past 14 years.
Do you see, Karen, a president who's going to leave it all on the field in 2016, like fighting the good fight right to the end? Or is there a kind of rope-a-dope strategy here and pass it on to the next president?
Well, I think that, you know, President Obama has, since his reelection, I think, really focused on his agenda and his goals and has been pretty impervious to criticism, which has come at him from all kinds of directions. And let's face it, I mean, the fact is Hillary Clinton, by many measures, is, you know, one of the most hawkish candidates in the race on either side, if you look at the plans that she has put forward to deal with ISIL. So, you know, I think that everybody's attention is just naturally going to move on to the choice in November.
Steve, in Charleston, South Carolina, a city that had its own tragic headlines this year with the shooting there, Dylan Roof and all the rest. Steve, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. My question for your guest is about Donald Trump and the rest of the Republican field seems to be so far to the right and pandering to a base that seems to be very angry. How will any of them be able to tack towards the center and actually be elected next year if they're going to have to be able to carry moderates and some Democrats in order to get the White House?
Steve, I will ask that question. May I ask you, Steve, how Charleston's doing at the end of this year after the terrible death toll there and the mass shooting at the church? How's the city recovering?
It's doing great. It really is. You know, the city has always been very close-knit place, and they've done very, very well.
We're glad to hear that, and we appreciate your call. Jack Beatty, what about a move back to the center by the GOP? Is that still the way it works?
There's some reason to doubt that. You know, the idea of the independent voter, the swing voter. Well, data shows there are fewer and fewer of those in polarized America. Yes, there is a middle in both parties, and yes, the parties tend to move toward it in the general election. But for example, if Ted Cruz is the GOP nominee, which seems a live possibility now, his whole raison d'etre is, I don't move to the center. The center moves to me. I'm pure right. Well, this week, Marco Rubio suggested that Ted Cruz has built into his position, say, on immigration, wiggle room, such that he can say one thing in the primaries and something else in the general election about immigration. Maybe he's done that across the board, and we'll see, if he's the nominee, that kind of movement.
Margaret in Richford, Vermont. Margaret, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. The story that hits me in the eyes every day and every night here is what I call the egregious ineptitude of the press to cover Senator Sanders' bid for the presidency of the United States. And I see it in the coverage of especially the last Democratic debate, when the issues were not addressed at all by the media. Senator Sanders brought up, he was the only candidate who brought up or the only contender who brought up global warming, and we had just had the Paris climate talks. And
so you want more agreement. Sanders coverage, Margaret, more.
Of course, more Sanders coverage on the issues that he is addressing every day, like Medicare for all and to fix the Fed, and also his foreign policy, which is so different from Hillary Clinton. And one of the most chilling things in that debate was when Hillary Clinton said she talked about the first Clinton
administration years, yeah.
Yes, but meaning her husband's presidency, and hers would be the second administration.
Margaret, we'll come back and look more at Bernie Sanders. We have to take a short break right here. I appreciate your call. Karen Tumulty with the Washington Post. Stand by. David Sanger, the New York Times. Jack Beatty, we're looking at the year in the news, 2015. We're at 800-423-8255. Benny King passed this year. Stand By Me, 1961. His song, died at 76. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea, I won't cry. I won't cry. No, I won't shed a tear just as long as you stand stand by me. And darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a year in the news this hour. The big stories, top stories of 2015, and in other news this year, in July, another big women's World Cup title for Team USA. That made it three, the same number as goals by U.S. midfielder Carly Lloyd in the final here against Japan.
Lloyd with Morgan streaking. She's chipping the goalkeeper!
In April of 2015, 17 million viewers tuned in to watch Bruce Caitlin Jenner's interview with Diane Sawyer on ABC. Sawyer asked the Olympic champion and reality TV star, "Are you a woman?" To which Jenner replied, "Yes."
My heart and my soul and everything that I do in life, it is part of me. That female side is part of me. That's who I am.
And actor Leonard Nimoy died in February at 83, beloved for his role as the one and only Mr. Spock in Star Trek.
They were brutal, savage, unprincipled, uncivilized, treacherous, in every way, splendid examples of Homo sapiens, the very flower of humanity. I found them quite refreshing.
Leonard Nimoy, gone in 2015. Karen Tumulty is with us from the Washington Post. David Sanger of the New York Times is here. And Jack Beatty, you can join us. What do you think? Will our grandchildren say we got on top of climate change this year? Are you still amazed the Supreme Court made gay marriage the law of the land? Where are we on police and race in this country? Our caller asked about Bernie Sanders' big business story or a malfeasance story in the business world this year from Volkswagen. The big cheat on automotive emissions got headlines in September. Here was their CEO, Martin Winterkorn, apologizing.
Ladies and gentlemen, millions of people all over the world trust our brands, our cars, and our technology. I am deeply sorry that we have broken this trust. I would like to make a formal apology to our customers, to the authorities, and to the general public for this misconduct.
There's not a moment of corporate glory. But Karen Tumulty, what about Bernie Sanders? And you heard our caller just before the break there saying she wants more coverage of Bernie Sanders. She's not getting what she wants out of this campaign season, and it's the dastardly press that's the problem. What do you say, Karen?
Well, I agree with her. I think Bernie Sanders has been undercovered by the press. But her specific beef, which was last Saturday night's debate, can I just plead on this one? This was a debate scheduled the Saturday night before Christmas.
Yes.
Those of us who and were stuck on the filing in the filing
system, yeah,
which is
yeah.
with a hockey rink in New Hampshire, were told that the debate was going to start at 8 p.m. It didn't start until 8:30. My first deadline was 9:30, and that was the end of being able to make the newspapers for the next day.
Wow!
I mean, it does. The Sanders people are complaining, and I think they have a legitimate beef here that these debates, which are the moments when their candidate should have his time to shine alongside the front runner, are being scheduled at moments that seem to be guaranteed that nobody will be paying attention, and that the media on I was there in the filing center, are under the worst possible circumstances for delivering that assessment.
Duly noted, it was engineered in a way for failure to be able to really explore, at least on that night, for somebody on a daily newspaper deadline for the next morning. But Jack, let me put it to you. Here's a listener. Ka says, I think 2015 shows increased friction between corporatist politics and those affecting ordinary citizens. Now, that's right on Bernie Sanders' button. He said in that campaign, Wall Street's not going to like me. Business is not going to like me. That's unusual for a prominent American presidential candidate to be voicing that. And after all these years of mounting inequality, the meltdown of the economy, there are real issues that he's addressing there. Do you see them getting a real workout in this campaign, or do they get washed over by the tides of American politics even now, Jack?
Well, I think they have gotten plenty of attention. I mean, perhaps not as much as our caller wants, but I've heard Bernie say this again and again. I went to a speech he gave up here. It was in a high school auditorium. The place was full. It was then full in a, this was in Lebanon, an overflow room was practically full. And what was striking was there were young people there. I mean, I was the oldest person by far. And, you know, they were tremendously enthusiastic, and they nodded their heads when he talked about the rigged race of American life. They nodded their heads when he said, I want to have free college tuition. They nodded and they cheered when he talked about Wall Street's business plan is corruption. So he's clearly striking a powerful note, and not just among, quote, left-wing Americans, but among lots of Americans who haven't really paid much attention to politics, but who certainly have been suffering the results of an economy that to many feels rigged.
Let's go to Kevin in Randolph, Massachusetts. Kevin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
It's been a year fraught with all kinds of stories, lots of anger and fear, police shootings and Planned Parenthood videos,
yeah.
ISIS. Everything that's so far been discussed today is pretty negative in nature. But smack in the middle of the year, I think my country grew up a little bit when the Supreme Court finally allowed gay marriage to be the norm. It was a wonderful, positive story. Inclusion and decency can never be a bad thing for any country. And I think that's one of the most heartening stories of the whole year.
Kevin, we've got it, and let us pick it up. June 26th of this year, 2015, it will be in the history books. Supreme Court declared marriage a fundamental right for same-sex couples in the United States. Folks celebrated on the steps of the court. Jack, I'm going to bring this one to you. Kevin says that there's a moment of light in this year.
Well, you know, Tom, the case introduced a constitutional right to dignity, a word that Justice Kennedy used 5 times in oral arguments. In his decision, Kennedy found that state bans on gay marriage violated the dignity of the union between same-sex couples. When Justice Kennedy ascribes dignity to an entity, one scholar notes, that entity generally prevails. What entity will the swing justice next ascribe dignity to? It could be a Christian photographer refusing to shoot a gay wedding, or a white student harmed by affirmative action. But, you know, one can also imagine the right to dignity as the constitutional basis for remedies to inequality. The harms of inequality, they range from the physiological to the psychological to the political, the rankling certainty that your voice is ignored by bought politicians. You know, a future court may find that outrageous inequalities violate the right to dignity, defined as, quote, the right not to be arbitrarily and therefore unjustly disparaged as a person.
Karen Tumulty,
you know,
this was a big issue.
The court was following the most extraordinarily fast change in public opinion that we have seen on a major social issue, certainly in my lifetime. Don't forget that as recently as 2008, everywhere that gay marriage was on the ballot, it failed, or it was, you know, bans were voted against it, that both of the leading Democratic contenders, Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, were against gay marriage. And there was such a big swing in public opinion that, you know, all of that changed, both, you know, even before the Supreme Court ruled. It was changing when it was being put up to the popular vote, and you saw, you know, both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton renouncing their previous positions.
Does that mean, Karen, that the culture wars are over, at least on this front, or are they still seething in American politics somewhere?
This culture war, I think, is over. You even talk to evangelical leaders, and they will tell you privately, look, you know, I'm still against gay marriage, but I look out in the pews and I see that our young people are in a different place than I am on this question. And by the way, among young evangelicals, there's an interesting dichotomy, because the poll suggests that they are more conservative than older evangelicals on abortion, but they are far more liberal on gay marriage. So I don't think the culture wars are over, but I think this battle is, and it's because, you know, again, it's just that young people feel very differently about this across the board than older ones do.
Let's go to New York, Port Henry, New York, and William. William, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I currently think that a lot of the problems and the conflicts that are being addressed in a lot of the presidential campaigns are being used as kind of a diversion and an easy way out when a lot of big core problems in our economics and our social issues are being wearing down on us. And it's frustrating a lot of Americans. And I think a lot of them are taking, you know, Islamophobia and all as an easy way out.
So you're saying international issues, global issues are what getting in the way of resolving domestic issues, William?
I believe that that is exactly what's going on in America. I think that there's a lot that needs to be taken care of on the home front that are being ignored in lieu of beefing up foreign, you know, policies and military acts against ISIS, when I honestly believe there's no true defense against self-radicalized terrorists.
So just strengthen from within as one answer to that. David Sanger, this puts us kind of on your turf. Do you see issues abroad getting in the way, intervening, getting in the way of Americans sorting out real issues at home?
You know, I think William's on to something, because if you look at the patterns in American history back to even colonial times, there's a great tendency when there is a lot of stress at home to look to an outsider to blame. And you see this in the Trump phenomena. You see it in the trade debate. You see it, you know, we're finding problems either in the Muslim world, in the export of terrorism, in foreign competitors taking our jobs and so forth, which doesn't mean that none of those are problems. All of them are. But there is a great tendency, as William points out, to blame those sometimes as a way to avoid discussing hard choices at home. But if you loop it back to the discussion you just had, I think there is some reason for hope if we look back at 2015. I think when historians look at this year, the gay marriage decision, the global warming agreement, which your caller from Vermont raised and which very few of the candidates have talked about, none of the Republican candidates have, the Iran deal that we talked about earlier, these may be the things that historians go back and say marked a significant change, even while you had this angry political upheaval that we've seen both in the reaction to Trump and on the left in the embrace of Bernie Sanders. You know, your caller suggested he hadn't gotten very much coverage. Well, maybe he hasn't, but he certainly pulled Hillary Clinton significantly to the left until the terror attacks came along.
Jack, I wonder, am I wrong to see, as different as they may be, some kind of connective tissue here between Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump? Trump talks about making America great again. You may or may not share his view of what that means, but implicit in that is strengthen this country, because we've got to be strong at home to be successful, happy, everything else in the world. That's right where Sanders lives.
Yes, Trump in the last debate said, imagine if we had spent the trillions we spent in Iraq on infrastructure. Well, imagine. It would have been a different country with high-speed trains.
It's kind of a dazzling vision. I mean, yes, imagine that. Just think of it.
Yes, yes. I mean, his attitude to foreign policy is let somebody else do it. Let the Russians do it in Syria. And, of course, foreign policy experts say, yike, you can't say that. He can say it. And the reason he can say it is most people feel, look, we can't get trapped down into another war. We have problems here at home. And that's Bernie Sanders' whole pitch.
Karen Timberley, how does that play out next year? I mean, there's been national security has been a huge issue for many years in American politics, but people feel weakness at home and they want to fix it.
Yeah, I just, you know, I wish I had a crystal ball on this one. I think a lot of it is going to depend on, you know, God forbid, if anything else happens. But there is an underlying economic insecurity in this country. And, you know, it has been spoken to increasingly by Republican candidates. You know, you hear that them talking as well about, you know, how essentially, you know, non-college educated whites are, you know, being, and that's, you know, part of their base, are being left behind. And also, you know, they now talk about, you know, the greedy Wall Street culture. So, you know, it's just such a difficult to predict year. And I think that, again, the big thing that has made it so difficult to predict is Donald Trump. I mean, his staying power has been beyond anything I think that anybody but his most ardent supporters would have thought when he stepped onto the stage.
Let me turn to another angle here. Race has been a huge issue this year. Again this year, we had Jonathan Butler at the University of Missouri. This was back in November. Lots of tension there. The president of the university resigned. He launched a week-long hunger strike, ended with that resignation, talked with ABC's Good Morning America, a microcosm of what's been voiced all over the country.
The campus climate here at the University of Missouri has been unlivable since I was here as an undergraduate student. So I started here at the university in 2008. And in my first semester here, I had individuals write the N-word on my wall. I had white students who were literally physically assaulting me. The campus culture here is just not welcoming to people who aren't of the majority identity.
Jack Beatty, right across the country, this message raised again and again this year that the old status quo assumptions about how power is shared and what's respected and where privilege lies just won't cut it anymore.
No, and no place more vividly than in Rahm Emanuel's Chicago. You know, in New York in 2014, the clearance rate for murder investigations, 70%. In Chicago, 28%. Lowest in decades, partly because Emanuel cut the detective force by 20%. African Americans in Chicago just can't get justice. The police abuse them, sometimes wantonly kill them, like 18-year-old Laquan McDonald. And the statistics suggest that the police could care less about arresting the murderers stalking the city's meanest streets. You know, the message of both police brutality and police indifference in Chicago is the same. Black lives don't matter.
David Sanger, here we are, and the story that may have the most historical consequence may have come out of Paris and the climate change agreement. If that works, we may deter the worst of climate change. If it doesn't, we're in for a whole lot of flooded cities on coast around the world. What do you see, David? Set up for a chance of success there?
Well, what it did was, for the first time, make sure that nations are accountable. And it's going to be a long time, and we're going to have a lot of radio shows between now and then. And maybe radio will be out of business by that time, by the time we figure out whether the climate change agreement worked.
Well, at least there's a foundation laid down and some hope in that. A lot more hard work to come on that front to stave off the worst. We're so grateful to all three of you for being with us today on this Christmas Eve. David Sanger with the New York Times in Washington. Thank you so much for joining us, David.
Thank you, and a great 2016 to you and your listeners.
Same to you. Karen Tubble, The Washington Post. Thanks, Karen.
Much appreciate the opportunity.
Jack Beatty, same to you, sir. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.